This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In 2003, his book, The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies, turned peak oil from an insider worry to a popular movement. 12 years and 8 books later, Richard Heinberg is still the go-to guy for what's happening with world energy, and there is a lot happening right now. Richard's post in California is at the Post Carbon Institute. And of course, everyone wants to know what happened to peak oil and the way out of this fossil fuel mess. Richard gives us that update and a whole lot more in his latest book just out called Afterburn, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels. Richard, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's great to be back with you, Alex.
Well, why don't we start with this? We all thought high oil prices would grind the economy into a crash. Now oil has fallen to less than half the price, as everyone knows, and it looks like that could trigger some very bad things. What's happening out there on the oil fields?
Well, what's happening is that, as I argue in a little op-ed I wrote for Reuters yesterday, what's happening is that Goldilocks is dead. Economics 101 tells us that there's always a Goldilocks price for everything, a price that works for both producers and consumers. It's high enough so that producers can make a profit. It's cheap enough so that consumers can afford it. Well, with oil, that just right zone of prices has pretty much ceased to exist. For oil producers, costs of production have been skyrocketing over the last decade. Year after year, oil costs of production have increased by 15 to 20% per year. And that led to very high oil prices over the last few years, around $100 a barrel. And at that price, the industry had the incentive to go after really tough new supplies like tar sands in Canada, but also like the tight oil reservoirs of North Dakota and Texas, where operators used fracking, hydraulic fracturing, and horizontal drilling to get oil out of what petroleum geologists previously considered rocks that were just too impermeable to bother with. Okay, so using this new technology, they were able to actually produce quite a lot of new oil over a short period of time. Now that has driven oil prices down by about half, down to about $50 a barrel, or even less in this country. And that's too low a price for the industry to operate, basically. And so drilling rigs are being idled, companies are bleeding red in their balance sheets. And sooner or later, this is going to result in declining overall production. But the problem here is structural. This is not just a temporary problem of supply and demand or finding the right price. There is no right price anymore, because if prices go high enough for producers so that they can reinvest in tar sands and tight oil, that's a price that's high enough to start undermining the economy. We've seen that over the past few years, where economic growth has basically come to a standstill because of high oil prices. And if prices drift too low, as we're seeing right now, then that kills the industry. There's no longer a just right price where it works for everyone.
And I've been reading some big energy companies hedge their production at over $90 a barrel. And so this could all transfer over to Wall Street. The people who took the other side of that bet, they can't pay half the world's energy bill. And you've got pension funds invested in this while the stock prices are falling. Something is going to give here.
Right. Over the past few years, energy junk debt has really helped drive what economic recovery we have seen since 2008. Part of what drove the fracking phenomenon was very low interest rates. You know, the Federal Reserve kept U.S. interest rates extremely low, and that made it possible for these small companies that specialized in tight oil production to take on enormous amounts of debt so that they could fund this really expensive business model. Well, now that all of these companies are hurting bad, that's inevitably going to impact the larger markets, and we may see the recovery start to falter. A lot of jobs are either directly or indirectly tied to shale gas and tight oil production here in the U.S. Already about 75,000 folks have been laid off from companies operating in the tight oil fields. And that's going to have knock-on effects as time goes on.
Let's get to your book, Afterburn. I was pleased to find your own evaluation of the book that started it all, The Party's Over. So briefly, how is that original book holding up?
Well, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people have said peak oil is dead, you know, now that oil prices are down and U.S. oil production is up. That's pretty much a refutation of the whole thesis. Well, I actually went back and reread the very first edition of The Party's Over to see how it stands up. And it turns out that some of the forecasts in that book actually have been pretty spot on over the last 12 years. Well, actually, I shouldn't take credit myself, because what I do in the book is really rely on the analysis and forecast of two veteran petroleum geologists who were sort of my mentors in this whole field, Colin Campbell and Jean Lahiriere. And they were both saying back in around the year 2000-2001 that world conventional oil production would probably peak around 2005-2010, but that would cause oil prices to increase, which would incentivize more unconventional oil production. And Jean Lahiriere suggested that unconventional oil production would peak out around 2015. Now, what we've actually seen over the past 12 years is rising costs of conventional oil production. Conventional oil production did stall out around 2005. It's been basically on an undulating plateau since then. Where we have seen increased production, it's in the unconventionals arena, just as they were saying, mostly tight oil and tar sands. And with the current declining prices and with the high per-well decline rates that we've seen, especially with tight oil, I think we're likely to see a peak in decline in world total liquid fuels output probably this year or next. So in retrospect, I think the best of the peak oil analysts were amazingly accurate. And yet, you know, here we are 12 years later with most of the energy pundits now saying, oh, well, we can forget about peak oil. It's a strange situation.
Yeah, and I can remember just about 5 years ago or so, a big debate between those who are sort of pushing climate change and peak oil. Some peak oilers said, well, we'll never get to full-blown climate catastrophe because the oil will run out soon, very soon. But now, Richard, doesn't it appear we will find enough liquid fuels, one form or another, to wreck the climate if we go ahead?
Well, you know, the climate is pretty well wrecked already. I hate to say, just with the amount of CO2 we've already emitted, we're already seeing some pretty disturbing impacts in terms of melting glaciers, sea level rise, destabilization of ocean currents, ocean acidification, increased rates of species extinctions, and on and on and on. What I think the more sober of the peak oil analysts were saying, at least this is what I was saying, was that the higher ranges of the IPCC forecasts for carbon emissions in the latter part of the 21st century were unlikely to come about because we just didn't have enough affordable carbon-based fuels to burn in order to get there. And I think that's still true. But I don't think that it's accurate, and I hope there weren't too many peak oilers out there saying that, therefore, we don't have to worry about climate change, because, in fact, it's the ecological time bomb that, you know, should have all of our attentions.
And in the middle of so many threats, this consumer society has managed to muddle along. We appear literally ready to shop until we drop. Richard, is it possible we can delay this crash for another decade or two?
Well, that's anybody's guess. Quite frankly, I'm a little surprised that we have put off a major financial reckoning as long as we have. I was expecting after 2008 that we would see that by this time we'd have a very different global economic condition than we actually observe around us. what happened in the intervening years, of course, was that governments and central banks deployed really extraordinary means to maintain the status quo. Quantitative easing, you know, creating trillions of dollars out of nothing to buy up government bonds, lowering interest rates, making it cheaper and easier for governments to take on more debt. But what these efforts have done is to create more financial bubbles. Basically, all of that new money pooled up within the financial system itself, the famous global 1% of the economic elite, have done extremely well as a result of all of this, but just about everybody else is treading water at best, or maybe a little worse off than they were before the 2008 crash. So we're in a very unstable situation, and it's impossible to say how long this sort of faux business as usual can be maintained, but it's inherently unsustainable, inherently unstable. So I think, you know, folks would be well advised to prepare for the worst, quite frankly.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with energy author and speaker Richard Heinberg about his new book, Afterburn, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels. All right, we're heading for trouble, as you say. How can we get through the coming bottlenecks with the least amount of suffering?
Well, in these kinds of situations, and I'm speaking here of a situation that's analogous to historic instances of civilizational collapse, in these kinds of instances, the best and worst of human nature both predominate. The worst of human nature in terms of ruthless competition for the remaining scraps and crumbs of wealth and biocapacity. I think we're likely to see that, and in some ways I think we already are. I believe the world's wealthy elites are pulling out all the stops to maintain and extend their unequal access to the world's riches. And we could see much more of that. We could see wars over depleting resources and wars over territory that's still viable in a post-climate change world. At the same time, we often see in times of crisis the very best of human nature coming to the fore in terms of cooperative efforts to basically, you know, fill up the lifeboats, make sure that everyone is in the community is cared for in some way. There are legions of stories, first-person accounts of natural disasters where, you know, these kinds of humanitarian self-effacing efforts predominated. So as time goes on, I think it's going to be important to create the conditions where those sorts of cooperative efforts will predominate. If we begin now to create the kinds of expectations and institutions that favor cooperation over ruthless dog-eat-dog, winner-take-all competition, then, you know, we're going to come out much better in the end. This is kind of a Darwinian moment, as I call it, in Afterburn. We tend to think of natural selection in terms of ruthless competition, but in fact, it's the species that learn to cooperate that tend to fare best overall in the long run. And hopefully we'll learn that lesson sooner rather than later.
Well, I want to get back to more about transition and localization just in a few minutes. But first, I'd like to return to one of the key ideas that seems so simple but is so major in what we have to grasp about this, and that is the difference between gross energy and net energy. Why does that matter so much, Richard Heinberg?
Well, it takes energy to get energy, and so we're constantly spending energy as a society to drill oil wells, to mine coal, to build solar panels, to build wind turbines, and we count on the fact that these efforts will pay off in energy terms far more than we invested. And that's generally true with our energy acquiring activities, but in varying degrees. So, for example, in the 1930s, we might have invested one barrel of oil's worth of energy in a drilling for oil and gotten 50 or 100 barrels of oil back for our efforts. That kind of energy return on energy invested ratio is dramatically declining as time goes on with fossil fuels, as we harvest the best and cheapest fossil fuels first and are constantly forced to go after lower quality resources as those better quality resources deplete. Well, it's also true that most of the renewable energy sources that we're looking toward now have a lower energy return on energy investment than was true of fossil fuels in the heyday of oil, coal, and natural gas back in the 20th century. So as time goes on, even though the world is producing and using as much energy as it was the previous year, or maybe even a little bit more, the net energy that is actually available to run all of our societal systems of agriculture, transportation, manufacturing, and so on, is less than what was actually available the previous year. Now, this is difficult to measure exactly. Nevertheless, it's a very real phenomenon, and it's bound to have economic impacts as time goes on. And, you know, when you just look at the gross figures for global energy production, it looks as though everything is basically okay. We have enough energy, and the amount of energy available, in fact, is growing. But it's when you look under the hood and examine that energy return on energy invested ratio that you realize that we're actually facing, in some ways, the law of diminishing returns. We're putting more and more energy into producing energy and money as well, but we're actually getting less useful energy out of the process with every passing year. Now, at some point, that will stabilize as we make the transition to renewable energy sources. But over the next several decades, it seems almost inevitable that our energy systems, which is what drives our economy, our energy systems are going to be subject to the law of diminishing returns and therefore not really able to support the kind of economic growth that we saw in the 20th century.
And then related to that, Richard Heinberg, in your new book, Afterburn, you write, quite simply, we must learn to be successfully and happily poorer. Now, somehow I don't think we'll hear that in the upcoming American election campaign.
Yes, I know. Everybody, especially if you're a politician, you want to proclaim that it's our birthright as Americans to be rich and everybody can be wealthy. But the fact of the matter is we live on a finite planet. And as population grows, as per capita consumption grows, we are drawing down Earth's resources. The Global Footprint Network, which monitors the Earth's biocapacity and human use of that biocapacity, tells us that we're currently using about 1.5 Earth's worth of resources every year. Now, that sounds nonsensical. How could that even be possible? Well, it's only possible because we're drawing down the biocapacity available for future generations. You know, we can do that for a while, but you can't do it for very long. So one way or another, we're headed into a future where we actually have less. And if we get that message now and learn to adapt, I think we can adapt. But unfortunately, we're all still living with this mindset that was developed during the 20th century when the problem was we had so much cheap energy that we manufactured products faster than people could use them, and we developed whole industries like the advertising industry to talk people into wanting more stuff. We developed consumer credit to make it possible for people to go into debt so they could consume now and pay later. You know, those kinds of strategies might have seemed to make sense back then in the 20th century, but today they're just propelling us faster and faster toward a brick wall. We need to get the message that we live on a full planet, and it's time for us to start to rein in our appetites and reproduction as well. There are just too many of us using too much stuff too fast. And as I said, we can adapt, but not if we go on with the illusion that there's enough for everyone to be wealthy.
But what about people like Stanford Professor Mark Jacobson, who we've had on Radio EcoShock, and Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute? They say we can continue growing the economy powered by renewable energy. Why are you so gloomy?
Well, I think some of those reports and plans are, how shall I say, a little over-optimistic. When you look at what's actually happening with renewable energy, the rates at which it's being adopted, the actual costs, early on, it's quite cheap to replace fossil fuels with renewable energy, and the costs of solar and wind are declining, especially solar. declining rapidly, while the cost of fossil fuels, as we've been saying, is increasing. So it would seem like a no-brainer that, you know, the market will drive this transition and we have no problem. The problem is that solar and wind are intermittent sources of energy. Sun isn't always shining, the wind isn't always blowing. That's not a deal killer. There are ways of making up for that with energy storage, with rebuilding the grid, with having massive redundancy of generation capacity. But those things cost money and energy. In the early stages, we already have the redundancy. We already have all of the fossil fuel infrastructure in place. So if the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing, we just pour on more coal or natural gas. But once we get to a pretty high level of renewable capacity, once we're getting 30% or half or 80% of our electricity all from renewable sources, then the requirement for investment in storage and in grid retrofitting and so on becomes pretty enormous. Also, we're only talking about electricity so far, and there's a lot of energy use. Here in the U.S., electricity only accounts for about 32% of the energy we use. So there's a lot of energy that we use in making steel and making cement, in transportation, that is going to be very, very hard to substitute with renewable sources. So altogether, that renewable energy transition is inevitable, it's necessary, but it's not going to be easy or cheap. And I think it's important that we understand that and prepare ourselves.
I just want to read you one more quote from your book, Afterburn. You say, when the government tries to provide people the basics, power is centralized. But as the capacity of the government wanes, it can feel threatened by people trying to provide the basics for themselves and act to discourage or even criminalize them. Are we seeing signs of government resistance to self-sufficiency and going off-grid?
Well, very definitely. And I think that's a trend that's likely to accelerate as time goes forward. As the grid becomes less functional because of the addition of more and more intermittent renewables, that causes utility prices to increase, electricity rates to increase, and that's an incentive for still more people to abandon the grid and go with battery backup solar power. And so what we end up with, ultimately, is a kind of power grid cycle of doom. And the result then is a much more decentralized society with people in their own homes making their own power, perhaps with 3D printers and gardens in the back and so on. So people who can afford this kind of situation, can afford their own power supplies and so on, end up doing pretty well during the transition, and lots and lots of other people get really left out. So unless we manage this transition well, it's going to, in some ways, exacerbate the kinds of economic inequality we're already seeing. Governments, for their part, don't like any of this. They want to maintain the status quo as long as possible, which means maintaining the power grids, maintaining the kinds of centralized production and transportation that we currently have. And so it's going to be a lot of contested ground all over the place.
Well, we're starting to run out of time here, but you do have some advice for people who want to change the world, and I know people need to read the book to get it all, but would you like to give us an idea or maybe two of how we can help make social change really work?
The first thing we have to understand is that the scale of change that inevitably will occur over the next few decades is vast. Even if we do nothing, society is going to change profoundly. So that means that there will be innumerable opportunities to impact that change, to guide it, to steer it. So for young people, this is quite an amazing time to be alive. If, as I say in the book, if you want to change the world, there's never been a better time to be alive, because the opportunities will be everywhere, in the food system, in the energy system, in the financial system. Basically, we have the opportunity to redesign all of these systems. We have the opportunity and necessity, in fact, of redesigning civilization from the ground up. So what I suggest to young people typically is, depending on what your talents are and what your ambition is, if you are more interested just in working at the ground level, find out how to supply for your community's needs at a local level, whether it's food or power or finance or whatever. But if you have a deeper interest in structural issues, then study how these systems work and how they're changing and how you could impact them, and insert yourself in these systems and make the changes happen. The changes will happen. It's just a matter of how they're guided and how successfully they're guided.
Well, listeners, even though I'm familiar with many of Richard's ideas, I really did enjoy reading the new book, Afterburn Society Beyond Fossil Fuels. It ties a lot of things together, and for me, it created some new insights and inspiration again. So I'll post links for all this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info, and you can check out Richard's longstanding blog and all things Heinberg at richardheinberg.com. Thank you so much for joining us, Richard. You are one of our most popular guests.
Oh, that's great to know, Alex. It's always a pleasure speaking with you.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.